government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulation.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion.
That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another Federalist Society Free Lunch podcast call for the Regulatory Transparency Project. We're glad you're here. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch podcast. I've been saying for a month now at the start of these calls that all Teleform listeners should go to the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our biweekly newsletter, to receive updates as we post new content, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Well, that must be working because we've reached over 100 Facebook and Twitter followers and 100-plus subscribers in just our first month of doing this programming. I wanted to say at the beginning of this call that we sincerely thank you for your support and ask for your continued support by sharing RTP content with your friends and colleagues so that we can grow our reach even further. Now, this Free Lunch podcast is entitled IoT, Rise of the Machines. Of course, what we are referring to is the Internet of Things. That is the idea of connecting almost any device to the Internet and the Internet to almost any device. Our goal today is to explore such questions as, what are the risks of such vast interconnectivity? Should it be regulated by government? And if so, how? How does the tech industry and manufacturers of internet-connected devices view risks posed by IoT? How are they dealing with them? And what devices and technologies can we expect from IoT industry leaders in the not-so-distant future? Here to discuss today's podcast topic are Paul Rosenzweig and Suhail Khan. Both of these gentlemen have distinguished backgrounds, so I will say only that Paul is an accomplished writer and speaker with a national reputation in cybersecurity and homeland security. He's the founder of Red Branch Consulting, a homeland security consulting company, and is a senior advisor to the Chertoff Group. We're very happy to say that Paul serves on the RTP's Cyber and Privacy Working Group and was a contributor to the paper we released earlier this week entitled Regulators in Siberia. That's C-Y-B-E-R-I-A, Siberia. A truly fascinating read that can be found at regproject.org. And Suhail serves as Director of External Affairs at Microsoft Corporation and is a Senior Fellow at the Institute for Global Engagement, a Christian religious freedom think tank. He has served on the Hill, in the Bush 43 White House, and at the Department of Transportation. More about Paul and Suhail can be found through our website at regproject.org. As we hear from our speakers today, keep in mind that the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch podcasts are those of the speakers. Now, let's turn to what you have all called in for. I'm going to turn the mic over to Paul to get us started. After his opening remarks, he's going to pass over to Suhail, and thereafter we'll take any and all questions in Q&A. Please be thinking about your questions during the remarks, or else I'll be free to rein to ask away. Thanks, Paul, and thanks, Suhail, for speaking with us on the Free Lunch podcast today. Paul, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks a lot, and thanks for having me. It really is a pleasure to join you in the program, and it's always a pleasure to participate with the Federalist Society in one of their informative podcasts. I listen to them as a consumer, and I'm always pleased when I get to contribute to the content of them as well. So let's start with a story, and the story is literally from this past weekend at the Black Hat Convention in Las Vegas. Black Hat, for those who do not know, is a convention of cyber hackers who have their own conventions, much like the ABA does, or much like any other professional society. It's a little different in its culture, of course, It's the first time I ever saw a man wearing a kilt and no underwear at a professional convention, but there you go. Notwithstanding the oddity of the people who attend, the work that they do is deeply serious and of importance to any American who is dependent upon cyber-connected systems, which is to say basically every American alive today. And the story I want to tell is about a presentation that was made at Black Hat by a hacker, a man named Billy Rios. Billy has been involved in examining the security of the Internet of Things systems for several years now. He did some seminal work on vulnerabilities in medical devices about 3 years ago. His presentation this week was remarkable. Billy examined vulnerabilities in a car wash, which sounds strange, right? But the PDQ laser car wash system is a completely cyber-enabled car wash system that is deployed at hundreds of locations throughout the United States. And unlike traditional car washes, there are basically no people there. There's one guy to take your money and manage it, but the entire thing is automated with cyber-enabled systems that allow you to plug in what you want in terms of cleaning, that open and close the doors to the car wash, that run the brushes and the arms, and so on. And it's a great, magnificent innovation that increases efficiency, no doubt reduces pricing, is exactly what we want from our new world of Siberia. What Mr. Rios demonstrated, however, is that the system could be hacked and that he could cause the brushes and arms of the system at PDQ Laser Wash to attack the car. If you went through the car while you were inside it, cause physical danger to the people who were inside the car. He could, for example, open and close the doors at either end remotely so that it could try and crush the car. He could he demonstrated a capability to use the arms to try and break through the windows and doors of the car. All very remarkable, very scary. So that demonstrates one of three possibilities of issues about the vulnerability of the Internet of Things. The first and most serious is that the Internet of Things can itself be a direct danger to human beings. Now, I have to say, before anybody on the call gets totally freaked out, that this was a proof of concept. It's never happened in the real world. There are lots of easy fixes that can be implemented relatively quickly, and nobody is going to get killed by their car wash tomorrow, just to be clear about it. But at least in theory, it's a potential vulnerability. Another bucket of vulnerabilities involves using the Internet of Things not as an attack on their owners, but rather as a vector for attacking other systems. For example, we've seen recently that things like refrigerators and toasters are being connected to the network. And this, again, is great. You can program your toaster from your iPad without having to get up and go touch it. There's no danger from that. The worst that happens is that your toast gets burned, which is hardly a major vulnerability. But it is the case that these unsecured Internet of Things devices like your toaster can themselves be transitioned into attacks on larger systems. If you read about the attack, for example, on the British healthcare system a few weeks ago, or on the U.S. Domain name system several months ago by a botnet called Mirai, that was also through the Internet of Things and unsecured devices that themselves became attack vectors for attacks on other parts of the network. Now, the third bucket of vulnerabilities arises not from using those systems maliciously, but from the privacy concerns that arise from the collection of information about their users. While it is true that your toaster, the only thing that's vulnerable is the possibility that your toast might get burned, it's also true that if I know when you use your toast, when you use your refrigerator, when you leave your house and your thermostat turns down, I start to have information about your personal habits that can be converted into value, either useful value, like helping sell you products that you might actually want, or malicious value, like knowing when you're not in your house and so that your house is vulnerable to robbery. So with that in mind, let me then just turn briefly to the idea of how should we think about this? Well, clearly there are issues here. Is this something that is government regulation, or is this something that the market will take care of? And I think probably Suhail will talk more about that from the perspective of a tech company. But as an initial approximation, we should be skeptical of a government approach and prefer a market regulatory approach. And the reason is not really that the market is perfect, but rather that government regulation is more imperfect than the market. We should be concerned, at least as a first cut approximation, with the rigidity of government regulation, its inability to be nimble, and its inability to keep up with innovation. And the prospect that the FTC, for example, might adopt regulations about security mandates in the IoT would also be the prospect for an immediate reduction in innovation in the development of IoT devices and the reduction in economic efficiency gains that we're seeing right now. That doesn't mean that there's no prospect at all for government regulation. One can certainly imagine some areas in which the market might fail or in which the market is unable to develop its own self-sustaining standard-setting system to increase security and privacy without burdening innovation too much. But I think we're a long way from that point. I can talk a lot more about that as we go down this road, but for now, I'll leave it there and turn it over to Suhail for some opening remarks.
Well, thank you, Paul, and I want to thank Devin and the Federal Society for this opportunity to share some of my thoughts on this very important and timely issue. I'm a big fan, as Paul is, of the Federal Society, and it's exciting to be a part of this discussion this afternoon. There's no doubt that, as Paul indicated in his introduction, that we are seeing a proliferation of internet-connected devices and sensors in our everyday lives that are digitizing our physical world, and that has been manifested and has become called now the Internet of Things, where everything around us, that many things that we take for granted, like Paul mentioned, toasters and car washes and other types of devices that we use every day are now connected to the internet, and that those everyday consumer objects and industrial equipment are enabling much more advanced device management, information gathering and analysis that helps increase efficiencies and productivity that really can be a benefit to consumers across the board. And that's something that, again, has a myriad of positive effects in our everyday lives. And we're seeing that from people that use devices that they wear when they're engaged in workouts and exercise or smart home devices in transportation, in public spaces, and indeed in the office space. And the data that is collected in those applications is crucial to the value of those devices, but also to the delivery of those services. But there are implications, as we've already raised, not only of liability, but also of personal privacy. And that's also another area that I hope we can discuss as part of this larger conversation. The bottom line is that people won't use technology that they don't trust. And as that technology is becoming more and more integrated into our physical worlds and our everyday lives, it's important that we continue to drive trust as a fundamental basis for that continued data collection, that use of that data, and the protection of that data throughout the ecosystem of the Internet, what we call the Internet of Things. So there are what we're proposing and continuing to foster from an industry perspective, and Paul is exactly right, many of the solutions really need to come from the private sector, from industry, and from consumers working together to provide protections as the technology continues to evolve, largely, again, for the benefit of our everyday lives, but being very cognizant and aware of new challenges and new potential threats that arise from the development and continued application of data collection, access to devices that hitherto were not connected to the World Wide Web. So there are these challenges we're convinced are surmountable, but there needs to be what we call a kind of a trust framework that will include security, transparency, control, de-identification, and of course use limitations. On security, privacy can't be attained without strong security, and there needs data breaches, as Paul mentioned in his opening remarks, that those data breaches erode and negatively impact not only the customer and the consumer's trust in their everyday devices, but also, of course, in the business value. So there must be a strong level of protection against unauthorized access, and indeed, there needs to be investments from the private sector that need to be made to reduce the threat of these attacks and the impact of any breach of that device or network of devices. There's no doubt that the Internet of Things will introduce these new threats, and security professionals in the private sector, but working in partnership with security professionals at government agencies, will need to diligently apply their knowledge of threat modeling and mitigation approaches to the Internet of Things to meet those heightened demands and those new threats as they continue to manifest themselves. Second, as I mentioned, is transparency. We all know the expression "sunlight is the best disinfectant," and that there's no doubt that this applies in this instance as well. That manufacturers, device manufacturers, tech companies need to fully disclose all data collection when in use in the Internet of Things. If the device does not have enough screen space to present meaningful notice, then there needs to be other ways to give that notice to the consumer through a linked device or other types of ways so that the consumer has full transparency and knowledge that the connected device is, in fact, has the presence of sensors and that there is associated data collection being occurring as that device is being used. Third is control. In many scenarios, it's required and desirable to provide people, consumers, with the ability to place limits on the data collection and have the ability to opt out of particular uses and or their willingness to share that data with others. And the more sensitive and obviously more potentially consequential the data is, the higher the degree of control that will be warranted. And so again, that ability to control that application and that data needs to be easy for the consumer. And again, that will be primarily on the shoulders of industry to provide that access and that ability for the consumer to have that type of control. Next up is de-identification. As devices are continuing to gather all kinds of data, very personal in many instances, there needs to be an ability for the consumer to have a choice to de-identify that data. And many times the data has very personal attributions, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the data has to be specific or has to be available to that that named individual. And there should be a way to de-identify that that data where possible and where it makes sense, so that if there is use for the larger data, that can be used and that can be shared, but it doesn't have to be associated with a particular name or other personal characteristics of the individual consumer. The other is use limitation, that there need to be, again, protections of that data and limitations on its use, particularly against discrimination. And there are a host of questions that are already being raised in our society about what can be used and how can that data be used and by whom as that's being collected throughout the use of, again, devices in our everyday lives. There, again, it may not be so much some industry players will be much more responsible than others. There will be demands from the consumers, obviously, that there be limitations on that use of data, but there's no doubt that there will be instances when these issues will either find themselves in the courtroom to be resolved by judges, or even simultaneously, there may be instances where Congress and other lawmakers may step in to put limitations on the use of data that is collected. One example that has come, for example, is many children in K through 12 scenarios are using devices and using technology, and that's all for the better in their everyday lives as they go about their education. But as that's occurring, there have been, of course, many questions raised about the data that is collected as those children who are minors, who don't have the ability to consent to the use of their personal and private data, and their parents or its school administrators often don't even know in some instances what's happening with the data that is constantly being collected. And of course, there are many ethical questions, not to mention legal, about the content that's being collected and what that can be used. If a seventh grader emails on a school system or on a school provided device a guidance counselor complaining of either mental health issues or health issues or any type of personal questions, can that data be stored? Can it be used later? Can it be used by school administrators later on for admission to an AP course, for example, or even beyond that, by college admissions groups in order to determine the suitability of a particular applicant for a slot at a particular university? There needs to be guardrails, and those are questions that are now being raised as each keystroke that individuals, including children, engage in when they're using devices in the classroom. These are some of the issues that are being raised. As I mentioned, industry has rose to try and meet these concerns, including some of the facets I mentioned, including security, transparency, control, de-identification, and use limitation. There's no doubt that there will be instances, as I mentioned, where the law will have to come into play, either through courts or through legislative bodies. But again, we feel that the primary onus for protections of the consumer comes through, first, an informed consumer making very informed decisions about what their data they want to make available as they're utilizing these devices in our everyday lives. And then secondly, by responsible companies in the private sector who are adhering to a sense of trust and continuing to preserve and foster a sense of trust with consumers as we continue to engage in this revolution of information and technology in our everyday lives. So I'll end there, and then we can continue our conversation and go to some questions.
Well, terrific. Thanks so much, Suhail, for those comments, and Paul as well. What I'm going to do is open the floor for questions, but after I do, I would like to give Paul an opportunity to respond to anything that he heard Suhail mention, and vice versa. So let me go ahead and open the floor. Everyone on the call, when you hear the prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on, you can request the floor by entering the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I'm going to open the floor right now. Okay, floor mode is on. If you'd like to ask a question of Paul or of Suhail, you can request the floor by entering star and then the pound button. We've got some questions queued up, but I want to give Paul, again, an opportunity to respond to anything that Suhail might have said, and also give Suhail an opportunity to say any other things before we get to these questions. Paul?
Well, thanks. That's great, and that's really a wonderful summary, Suhail. It's clear to me that the optimum answer here is the development of strong standards of behavior that are industry developed and industry maintained as a way of guiding development. We're going to face a huge amount of interesting questions about control and use. When you were talking about the students in high school, I was, and elementary school, I was thinking about my mother, who is we are going to get her a pillbox, a smart pillbox that reminds her when she should take her pills because she's getting old and quite forgetful. And the questions that my brother and I have faced about whether or not we wanted to share that information with her doctor, whether she wanted to share that with us, her sons, and it's fascinating. The one piece that I do want to address that has kind of not gotten quite enough attention in our discussion so far is the critical one at the very back end about an enforcement mechanism. There are choices to be made, and we've focused mostly on the market as the enforcement mechanism, with the hope and indeed the expectation, as you would expect in any good regulatory transparency project podcast and any Federalist Society podcast from some of its participants, the expectation that the market is the best disciplinary mechanism for failures. That if manufacturers don't provide adequate privacy protections, adequate security, then consumers will go to other products. The interesting question I think that we haven't addressed is whether or not the creation of standards might also result in the development of liability enforcement mechanisms, which is to say that private sector voluntary standards have a way of becoming over time enforceable tort or commercial standards in the courts of law against by becoming the measures against which manufacturers' conduct is measured and assessed, and presumably it would be some form of negligence or maybe product liability yet to be determined. And I think one of the fascinating questions that we're going to face over the next, 5 to 10 years, is whether a liability protection enforcement mechanism, with all of the burdens that come from it, including opportunity costs and the transaction costs that come from litigation, is superior to a regulatory enforcement model from the government, or some yet to be identified third model, like a taxation model or a subsidy model, to develop to encourage or the development of good security in the IoT, or punish bad one, or if the market model is going to be sufficient unto itself, such that we don't need any government intervention at all. My own view is that's really dependent upon how far in front of the problems that Suhail has identified manufacturers get. If they're aggressive and forward-leaning and put in place good self-regulatory models, then we will probably forestall a liability and a regulatory regime. If, however, manufacturers continue down the road where many of them are right now of trotting out toasters that are completely unsecure, have no privacy rules behind them, have no use limitations, and virtually no transparency or control, then we may very well see a governmental response, which I think would be an understandable result, but in the long run, a very unfortunate one that diminishes innovation substantially. So I just wanted to kind of scope out the possible future of liability or regulatory responsibility as a counterpoint to an inadequate private sector response in the event that the private sector is inadequate in its own development of good standards.
No, you're right. Well, I think we definitely have to acknowledge that, and I appreciate the added remarks. Suhail, is there anything you'd like to say before we get to questions?
No, thanks, Devin. I would say that Paul is exactly right, and I think as we've seen in other instances throughout our history, that will be a back and forth. Industry will strive, and we hoped, and we in my industry strive to continue to preserve that trust and to meet those needs. But there'll be no doubt that there will be legislators, for example, that already in the Congress, for example, who are introducing legislation to protect consumers. For example, there is legislation that was introduced in the Senate by several senators to protect drivers in auto security risks, not only from driverless vehicles, but even from vehicles that have that are connected to the internet. There has been legislation already to protect drivers and consumers from potential hacks. Because we've seen, as Paul articulated, that people with very negative intentions can hack into devices, including vehicles, and can wreak havoc. And there are also, of course, are federal agencies like the FTC that have the ability to regulate and have often stepped in to provide regulation. And that, of course, is subject to political pressures and subject to the philosophies of the particular legislators and or the regulators, and so that constant push and pull will continue, and the Internet of Things is of course not immune from that from those processes.
Thanks for those additional remarks, Suhail. We're going to go ahead and go to our first question. We've got quite a few queued up. Again, for anyone who's interested in asking a question, all you need to do is press the star button and then the pound button, and you'll be added to the queue. Caller, when you hear the prompt, you can ask your question. Here we go.
Hi, my name is Devin Watkins from the Cato Institute. My first question was about you talked about security and keeping that privacy. I wonder about how the kind of Internet of Things is going to potentially compromise that security. I can imagine hackers, for instance, getting into the development process of some kind of printer or phone or toaster or some other connected thing, and then using that to get around the primary protection in most companies, which is their firewall. And if you can get any kind of access to the manufacturing or the BIOS of one of those devices, it seems like you could easily compromise their firewall. And my second question had to do with national security implications of these kind of things. With so many devices out there that are potentially hackable, do you think that there's a much higher risk of potentially foreign actors using these devices to cause havoc on a large scale, either through like terrorist operations or whatnot?
I think I'll tackle the first part of your question, Devin, and let Paul, as the resident expert on national security, tackle the second part. But to answer your question regarding the security, that, of course, is a reality, and my sense is that we'll have to build a better mousetrap. The tech sector will have to continue to be one step ahead of the hackers by providing better security features and, you know, that much higher of a firewall so that the hackers can't breach the features that will be built in to particular devices. And, of course, as in any consumer arena, the level of security in a given device will vary by manufacturer, and that, again, will be something that will be subject to consumer demand and consumer choice as to the features that various devices will have when it comes to the security features. I remember I'm still one of those folks that remember when the first BlackBerries came out before other phone devices were made available, including iPhones. And, you know, as somebody who held on to my BlackBerry probably a little longer than most, one of the features I did in keeping my BlackBerry a little longer was that it had a better security feature. And so that'll be something, again, that an informed consumer can make as the tech sector continues to meet the demands of keeping our devices protected. Paul?
Well, I think those are exactly the right questions. There is no doubt that the expansion of the use of IoT is going to expand the attack surface, potentially vulnerable attack surface. I read a wonderful thing the other day about an attack on a company through an internet-enabled fish tank in the corporate offices. So that's just the reality of it. As to whether or not it's a national security problem, that depends. I think it really depends right now on whether or not the next phase of IoT development fully incorporates the principles that that Suhail identified and works to create systems that are robust enough to withstand, you know, most attacks. The reality is that we've rushed towards the Internet of Things without applying many of those formulations to the fish tank I just mentioned, for example. If we don't, you know, heed the early lessons, then yes, I think that creating an increasingly vulnerable attack surface, along with an increasing dependency on the connected devices, is a national security risk of one form or another. Melissa Hathaway, who was a cyber advisor to both President Bush and President Obama, said exactly that at an ABA standing committee meeting just a couple months ago. She said she thought that without some intervention now, either through corporations or through regulation, that was her take on it, that the IoT would become a national security problem. And I certainly can see that. I think that the challenge right now is to try and avoid that as much as is possible.
Thanks so much for those responses, Paul and Suhail. Caller, hope that answered your questions. You got a twofer there. Before we get on to our next questions, I want to remind everyone that you can press the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keypad if you want to request the floor, and we'll get to your question in the order that it's received. We've got a couple questions queued up. I'd like to make an announcement about the Regulatory Transparency Project first. That is that our next free lunch podcast call is going to take place next week, Wednesday, August 2nd at 12 o'clock noon. The call will feature Howard Root, who is the former CEO of Vascular Solutions, a medical device research, development, and manufacturing company. Howard's going to walk us through his 5 years, 121 attorneys, $25 million battle with the Food and Drug Administration and Department of Justice to save his company and himself. Again, tune in next Wednesday, August 2nd at 12 o'clock noon to hear Howard's epic story. So I'm going to go back to the floor here. Caller, when you hear the prompt, you can ask your question.
Hello. I wrote a limerick about Imran. It goes, from when of lies the press did speak, their downfall took about a week. There is no court can punish sin as quick as market discipline. And it seems to me that in regulating the Internet of Things, the press and word of mouth is going to be a far more effective thing than a slow-moving regulation process. And isn't it better that we allow the market to do it than we have a completely involuntary system in which the FCC tells us that 3,000-year-old herbs can't be used to treat medical conditions?
Well, again, as I indicated in my remarks, most of the solution when it comes to the challenges faced by the proliferation of internet-connected devices will come from the private sector. And what we're proposing as a leading industry player is that there needs to be the best practices, as Paul indicated, including for cybersecurity, and that there should be certain standards that are not enforced by government edict, but by demands that consumers make upon manufacturers across the board, whether for internet providers, device manufacturers, etc. And that's where the solution we think will continue to develop. And just to articulate some of those best practices, you know, there needs to be hardware, for example, that has very basic and minimum requirements that should include minimum features for its operation that do have a basic security requirement, that they're tamper-proof, making hardware tamper-proof, that the hardware is secure, and that the upgrades, as they're made available, that those are secure. You saw recently when you had the WannaCry attack on a very outdated Microsoft software. That was because many consumers continue to use outdated software that was, in fact, vulnerable to attack. And so whether it's hardware or software, the industry is striving to make that hardware or that software protected and stronger in its security features, but it's also up to the consumer to be informed and to make the upgrades when those are available so as to continue to meet the challenges that we face when it comes to those who, again, seek to do us harm.
So this is Paul. I think your argument is exactly right, but it's also incomplete. You've mostly focused on the fact that regulation is too slow and therefore not nimble enough for this dynamic environment. There's at least two other reasons to think that government regulation is unlikely to be effective, particularly in this domain. The first is the very traditional one of regulatory rent seeking, which is to say that we're not exactly sure that the regulations will actually reflect the best judgment, but rather the one that is most likely to please the largest number of people who get to the regulator. And then the second one, or the third one, is that regulations are notoriously sticky. They don't change rapidly on a timescale that meets this particular domain, the domain of the Internet of Things. Those are, routinely seen as problems with regulatory responses in far less dynamic areas like occupational health and safety or the environment, and they're particularly salient here. The only thing that I could say in not in defense of regulation, but at least as a warning to those who might consider that regulation is unlikely to ever be trotted out or impossible, is that cybersecurity really does have a lot of externalities to it that are contrary to some parts of the market. My cyber insecurity in the laptop that I'm using right now is not just a threat to me, but it also is a threat to other people on the network with whom I'm connected. And so there is some sense in which I spend only enough money to protect myself, and I don't really care about you. That, I don't think, overcomes the anti-regulatory argument, far from it, but we should recognize that the cybersecurity market is at least right now a little imperfect, and that's mostly an information asymmetry problem.
Thanks again for those remarks, Suhail and Paul. We've got another question queued up, and I think we may have time for at least one other, so I'll ask again that if you're interested in asking a question of Suhail or Paul, you can go ahead and press star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll queue you up for a question. Before we go to our next question, I'd like to make one more announcement, and that is that we have a live in-person panel event scheduled for Wednesday, August 9th, from 12 o'clock noon to 1:15 p.m. at the law firm of Crowell & Mooring in D.C. The event is on the topic of occupational licensing, antitrust, and innovation, and will feature five different experts, including the acting chair of the FTC, Maureen Olhausen. The event's completely free to attend, and lunch will be provided. This event is open to everyone. However, in-person space is limited, and therefore we have to cut off registration once we've reached capacity, which by current numbers looks like will happen very soon. So hurry to our website at regproject.org to learn more and to register for the event under our news tab at the top of the homepage. Okay, if you have a question, press star and pound. I'm going to go to the next question now. Caller, when you hear the prompt, you can ask your question.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS, and we're about ready to start building the physical internet, which is a network of horizontal elevators where you get in it, you tell the computer where you want to go, and you get packets switched around a city, similar to Hyperloop. And in this particular case, we've been working on this for 20 years. And we think this is an essential area for federalism, where we divide sovereignty between the states and the federal government, not only for worrying about outside hackers, but if you get in one of our pods and you're Japanese Americans, I could send you to an internment camp. Or there needs to be both internal discipline for controlling government behavior and the ability to police bad corporate behavior or bad threats from the outside. I highly recommend people look at the internalimprovements.com, which has five presidential veto messages about federal involvement in infrastructure and how do we get a regulatory environment where we get a balance between states holding the federal government accountable and the federal government holding the states accountable.
Well, Bill, thank you for your question. I'm not exactly sure it's related to IoT, although I'm pretty sure we can connect JPODS, or JPODS are perhaps already connected to the internet. Suhail, Paul, do you have any response to what Bill just mentioned? Maybe you do, maybe you don't.
Well, no, I'll take a swing at it, because one of the things that Bill mentioned that is important is that he did advance another good argument for federal regulation, one that is that we also should not leave on the table, again, stipulating for everybody who's listening that in general, I don't find it sufficiently persuasive to overcome my instinct that regulation would be a burden in this area, which is that in the absence of federal regulation, there is the prospect for multiple inconsistent state regulation of systems that would retard the development of innovative IoT. If, for example, California had one requirement, New York had another, and Delaware had yet a third. Manufacturers would obviously have to manufacture to whichever standard was the most stringent and the most difficult to meet, and then sell into the other markets anyway. So perhaps it wouldn't be that big a problem on a federalism concern, but there is an argument for federal preemption of the field, perhaps with as light and as limited an amount of regulation as is necessary to reassure consumers without frustrating innovation and development.
I actually think that federalism, when I mean federalism, I mean diversity of state regulatory frameworks, because uniformity and excellence are mutually exclusive. And it is federal highway policies that created climate change and oil wars and a 48% dependence on foreign oil. So it's that monolithic, everything is the same, as opposed to the way the Constitution was written with the post-roads restriction and the ports restriction, was to require diverse state economies that would allow innovation in different areas so that we would get better federalism, not federal preemption. Because it's the federal preemption that resulted in the internment of the Japanese Americans or the moving of the Indians. And you have to protect against both bad actors and bad governments.
Thanks so much, Suhail. Thanks, Paul. Bill, I hope that answers your question or that that was responsive. Great question. I'm going to go to the next question now. Looks like we've got two more. We're 10 minutes away from running up on the 1 o'clock hour. So, callers, if you can ask your questions very quickly, we'll get some responses from Paul and or Suhail. And then I'm going to ask if Paul or Suhail have any closing remarks. So, callers, when you hear the prompt, please ask your question quickly.
Hi, yeah, I just wonder if national security should be the magic words that will open the door so that the federal regulatory bull can get into the market China shop.
Well, this is Paul. I certainly think that that's one possible avenue for federal regulation to take. Another would be consumer protection and safety. That's one of the reasons that the last year, the Federal Trade Commission advanced the idea that it might consider regulating security in the IoT, was for consumer protection. The safety issue is probably most salient to IoT devices that are life mission critical, like your car or a medical device, and we've seen the regulatory impulse already started at both the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration for cars and at the Food and Drug Administration for medical devices. So you are exactly right that the regulatory impulse runs on perceptions of risk, whether they're national security risks or consumer safety risks, is sometimes variable.
Thank you, Paul. Suhail, do you have any comments on that?
No, just I fully agree with Paul. Again, that brings into play what we discussed earlier, in that, you know, this is we live in a democracy, and democracies are messy, and that there's no doubt that industry has a role in this arena, and I've tried to articulate the responsibilities that industry has in this with this issue, and of course that consumers likewise have their role and their responsibility when it comes to protecting our data, but also as consumers, as voters, likewise have a role in choosing legislators and of course, representatives, our president and vice president, who will make the appointment to the relevant governing and regulating bodies that will also make decisions, partially based on politics, but hopefully will make decisions that are positive in their policy scope. But that, of course, will depend on, again, on an informed voter who also is an informed consumer, making good decisions so that we can strike that balance, and of course that balance will continue to be in play, from issue to issue and industry to industry and device to device as those are being regulated by various agencies in our government.
Great. We have one more question left. I'm going to close the floor after this question, and then after the response from Suhail and or Paul, we're going to go ahead and have some final remarks from both of them, if they have any, and that'll be the end of our call today. So, caller, when you hear the prompt, you can ask your question.
So, Paul, it's Chris Carlson from the West Virginia Attorney General's Office. Thanks so much for your time. It's been really, really enlightening. My question is about the implications of consumer consent when allowing data collection. For instance, the automatic vacuum maker Roomba just pretty much said that they're going to sell their mapping data of consumer homes. They allow that. I mean, consumers consent to that data collection, but are they consenting to a third party getting access to that data? Just interested in your thoughts.
Oh, thank you for that very thoughtful and timely question. That, again, we see from an industry perspective is something that, again, consumers, as you indicated, need to have full knowledge, and that goes back to my earlier presentation about being able to limit the use of data that's being collected. And so not knowing the full details of the Roomba example, this is the first time hearing of it, but again, if somebody is buying a device that they're hoping will keep their floors clean from, and you know, they're consenting that the device is able to map their home so it doesn't bump into, to spot as is keeping the house clean, but they don't consent for that that data to be in turn sold to others outside the home for use. Any number of purposes, then obviously that would be something that would be at the very least a breach of the trust framework that I articulated earlier, but perhaps something that could, as I mentioned earlier, could end up in the courts as a breach of contract if that was something that, again, was not something that was contemplated by the purchaser and the user of this particular device. And again, as Paul indicated, in the interest of consumer safety, there's instances of like that which we would argue violate, again, the trust of the consumer, would only push regulatory bodies and legislators to come in and seek to regulate the use of such devices, which we're always nervous when that occurs because it can be imperfect. And that's why, again, we put the onus on the manufacturers and the industry as a whole to, again, maintain that consumer trust.
Sue Hale, is there anything you'd like to add as sort of closing remarks here?
Well, thank you. And I just want to say thanks for including me in this discussion. I've really enjoyed the questions and the back and forth with Paul, somebody whose intellect and legal acumen I hold in high regard. But I'm really honored to be a part of the Federal Society discussion today, and I'm just grateful for this opportunity. And again, thanks for all the callers who called in with all the thoughtful questions.
I would just close by echoing first what Suhail said about having to thanking you for the opportunity to join. But the other thing I would say is simply that to everybody listening, I think that this is one of the areas of law and policy that are ripe for lawyerly engagement over the next 3 to 5 years. It is by no means clear to me either what the right answer actually is in terms of precise balances in law and policy, nor is it clear to me that we're going to get to those right answers without the engagement of lawyers, both in litigation, in legislation, and in standard development within organizations and manufacturers. So anybody who's listening, if you're looking for a new area to work in, this is it.
Well, thanks again, Paul and Sue Hale, for those final remarks and all of your enlightening remarks and answers on our podcast call today. And I join with Paul and Sue Hale in thanking our audience for joining us. Really great questions. We hope that everyone that's joined this call will join us again this upcoming Wednesday, August 2nd at 12 o'clock noon for our next installment of Free Lunch, when we'll hear from former CEO of Vascular Solutions, Howard Root. Until then, we are adjourned.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers, and You can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.